LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Doug Lane, who joins us to discuss some of the ideas in Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. After 1989, capitalism has successfully presented itself as the only realistic political economic system, a situation that the bank crisis of 2008, far from ending, actually compounded. Fisher's book analyzes the development and principal features of this capitalist realism as the lived experience of our everyday lives. Using examples from politics, film, literature, work, and education, it argues that capitalist realism colors all areas of contemporary experience, is anything but realistic, and asks how capitalism and its inconsistencies can be challenged. For Fisher, spiraling rates of poverty, inequality, depression and disenchantment are warning signs that the system as we know it is in deep trouble. Capitalist realism is a scathing critique of the post-ideological malaise which maintains that the economics and politics of free market neoliberalism are givens rather than constructions. Mark Fisher's writing put Zero Books on the map in 2009, and capitalist realism continues to define their mission. Fisher's vision remains as powerful and poignant as ever, adopting a new dimension in the wake of his untimely death in January 2017. Hello and welcome, Doug, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Doug, you're here today. We're going to be discussing the contents of a new book published by Zero Books, Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? And that's by the late Mark Fisher, and the reason I'm talking to you today is simply because, as I say, Mark is no longer with us. Perhaps right. To get us started, perhaps you could just tell listeners just a little bit about who you are, and then about your involvement with the publication of this book, and then just a little bit of an overview of what we're going to be discussing.
Okay, well, the book is not new. It's actually it was published almost a decade ago. It was published in 2009. And it was published by Zero Books. I am the publisher of Zero Books. I'm the technically my title is publishing manager. I'm a freelancer for Zero Books. And when this book was published, when Fisher's book Capitalist Realism was originally published, I was not involved as the publishing manager at Zero Books. In fact, it would be fair to say that Mark Fisher was, if not the publishing manager, shared that position maybe, or had some influence on that position at that point. He and a man named Tarik Goddard founded Zero Books, and they published quite a lot of really interesting books in their time. They had their controversies, as well as any left-wing press does. So I want to make it clear that Mark Fisher not only published a really interesting book that continues to sell well for the imprint I'm with now, but he founded Zero Books along with Tarik Goddard, and a lot of what we do is still kind of in light of what he's done. Or, you know, I think of capitalist realism as sort of a founding document for the whole press.
Okay, well, in my recorded introduction, I've set out an overview of our discussion from my perspective, you know, how I see it. Perhaps you just give us your, you know, in a nutshell version of it, you know, what the term means, you know, what Mark meant by capitalist realism.
Right. Well, I mean, I'd like to, before Mark died, I thought of capitalist realism as an important book for the imprint and one that I wanted to transcend. And it's still true that I want to transcend, this book. And I think he wanted to transcend this book, as well. I mean, obviously that's the whole point of getting beyond capitalist realism. I mean, that getting beyond capitalist realism is the point of writing a book like capitalist realism. So my perspective on it is this. It was a cultural critique, and it is a cultural critique of capitalism. And it's and it is a profound one. It is an evocative one. It is one which rings true and is true often. However, my perspective on capitalist realism is that, what makes capitalism stick around, the reason why it's, such a problem is not only cultural, but that it is an economic system which has to be understood and overcome on that level, on the level of economics, before you can get rid of the ideology of capitalist realism. But there are reasons why capitalist realism, or in other words, the idea that we can't get beyond capitalism, is so pervasive today, and they're grounded in history, and they're legitimate reasons. I mean, the failure of 20th century socialism, really existing socialism, and, you know, the Soviet Union and China, is one reason why capitalist realism is so pervasive today. The fact that we've had major crises. I mean, this wasn't the case when he wrote the book, but it is the case now. We've had major economic crises, that seem to point to fundamental flaws in the capitalist system, and which nonetheless do not move people on the left to organize in any reasonable way against capitalism itself. So we do appear now more than ever to be stuck in a moment of ideological capitalist realism or cultural capitalist realism, even in subcultures on the left.
Just a bit of, I suppose, what we call housekeeping regarding political perspectives here. I mean, I've interviewed people here right across the political spectrum, from hardcore libertarian anarcho-capitalist types, right through to universal income,
sure,
and more conventional things closer to the center, on, you know, coming from both sides. It's a cliche in itself to say that I don't buy into, you know, left or right, because I take each case on its merits. And one of the first things that happens if I read about some sort of ism or other and think, oh yes, I mean, I can sign up to that, I then immediately start finding details in the small print that I don't want to sign up to. And I meet people who are also the same type of ismerist that I vehemently disagree with. And
sure,
that's why I just can't bring myself to sign up to anything. Now, that brings its own kind of pitfalls. Who are you? What are you? Find it quite often we're having to define ourselves in terms that other people can understand. But
yeah,
all of that kind of given, whatever you can take from that, I mean, everything that I've talked with you about, a lot of your material that I've read and listened to, you're coming from the left. I mean, is it enough for listeners to sort of say, okay, this guy, Doggy's coming from the left?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm not going to hide that. And, you know, I want to explain why I think it's important to be open to defining yourself as coming from the left or the right or the center. But especially if you feel like you are leaning towards the left, it's important to say so. I think the distinction is a true one. I don't think that it is the being on the left makes you moral or makes you more likely to be correct with the facts. People on the left are often wrong. But there's an overall perspective about society that I agree with that comes from the left. And the way I think of it is, it comes from Slavoj Žižek, who's a far left philosopher, Marxist, psychoanalyst, and all of that. And he says that the difference between the left and the right is where you place the problem in your society fundamentally. So if you're on the left, No, let me start with the right. If you're on the right, you believe that fundamentally society is harmonious, that people can get along, that people have a natural way of interacting and behaving, that there are natural categories that people belong to, that there's a system that is also kind of coming out of nature, and that the difficulties that people run into in day-to-day life are there because of some outside influence, some failure to properly get engaged in an organic community. Often enough, you know, the problem is some outside society, some other group apart from your society, but it could be something else than that. But on the left, the perspective is that society is always going to be split or fractured or riven with problems, that no one system is ever going to be perfect, and that the goal should be to understand your own society and system, see what is going wrong with it, and go beyond it, transcend it, create something better. That isn't just like a problem under capitalism, although that's the system we're under now. But it's sort of a position towards reality itself. In other words, you know, you're just never going to be sitting still if you're on the left. You're always going to be critical if you're on the left. And that's, I think, a fair position. As I get older, it's more difficult to maintain in daily life. And in fact, I think that's probably all for the better. I think people are attracted to the left when they're young, because they feel so out of place. They're so insecure. They're not sure about fitting into the world. And so to see problems in the world, in the society, kind of gives you an out, and it also gives you a way to define yourself. But if you can get beyond the teenage version of the left, I think it's possible to live a relatively stable life and remain critical of the society that gives you that stability.
I think what drew me to, because I said I find myself very alienated by conventional politics all my life, or certainly all the years I've been paying attention to it. And what drew me to, I mentioned anarcho-capitalism, what drew me to that was, and again, there's different versions of that, different manifestos as to, you know, what that is supposed to be. But it was this idea that was very seductive, actually, particularly when I first read about it, which was like the idea of a voluntary society whereby society is always going to be split, if you want to put it that way, or let's just say diverse, and that if you and I agree on a particular subject at a particular time, then we can cooperate on that, and that which we disagree on, then we choose not to. We're not going to hang around and annoy each other, irritate each other, or do violence to each other because of different perspectives. We'll just go our own way, and in some form of free-flowing, freely interacting, each case on its merits, as I mentioned a few moments ago, different people will work together with other people on different areas, and society will kind of self-organize. And that sounds a lot like your right-wing perspective that you gave, you know, that that there's a fundamental harmony there. If things can just be allowed to kind of settle, and I admit then that the anarcho-capitalist critique of the left, or indeed any kind of like interventionism, is other people saying, no, this is what we're going to do, and if you don't like it, it's tough. These are the rules. This is the way things are set up. I don't care if you don't agree. We're the majority. You know, this idea of democracy mm-hmm. being 51% of the people telling 49% what to do. And in my moving around in anarcho-capitalist circles, I've certainly met people who've more or less signed up to that type of doctrine, who would definitely be described as from the left by, you know, other casual observers, and people who are very much far to the right, economically or perhaps socially to the right. I don't know what you've read about that, but anarcho-capitalism, that is to say, or just anything that could be compared to it.
I've read a bit, but not. I'm not an expert in anarcho-capitalism, but I know a lot about. I think I know quite a lot about capitalism.
Yeah.
You know,
the idea, the basic idea is, perhaps I should just clarify, the basic idea is that capitalism, as people would just think of it, if you just look up the dictionary definition and then you look up, you know, communism or socialism, whatever, it all starts to look very similar in the way that it's kind of different flavors of bullshit, whatever it happens to be. It's the same type, it's the same fundamental type of structures, but just, you know, people often make the comparison, don't they? You go to the extreme right and the extreme left, and whoa, they meet up around the other side.
Right. Well, listen, that's the horseshoe theory. You know, here's the thing about what you've been saying. What I find really interesting is how much a Marxist like myself, or I call myself a wannabe Marxist because I don't think I've read enough Marx to graduate to the level of actually being a Marxist. So I'm only a wannabe Marxist. But how much supposedly, you know, the diametrically opposed opposite of an anarcho-capitalist really shares the same values as anarcho-capitalists. In other words, a Marxist is the whole thing about Marxism is that at its root, before it got taken up by, you know, politicians, it was about trying to give workers their freedom. And one of the reasons to oppose capitalism was the way it took time and freedom away from a huge swath of people, based on how much property they had, and swept them, made people propertyless and swept them up into a system that just didn't care about what their individual desires were, but put them to work for its own ends. And I say its own ends rather than their own ends, because capitalism is a system where human relations are now being mediated by commodities or by, you know, products. So what becomes most important is not what any particular person wants, but what the demands of the system of producing, let's say, iPhones and desks and, you know, soda pop and cars and, you know, the whole slew of modern commodities. That system makes its demands over all people. So the difference between an anarcho-capitalist and a Marxist is not on the level of how much freedom do we want, but where we place the blame for our unfreedom. And so it really is a technical disagreement. In other words, we have a different analysis of what capitalism is, and we understand capitalism and as a system differently, come to different conclusions about it. But the goal of freedom is the same on each side.
Well, I mean, I've met people throughout my life, you know, hung around with a lot of, hippies and people who would absolutely call themselves left wing. And what they were about was very much about this freedom, just, you know, to be left alone, to do their own thing. And if they want to work all day and make things and buy and sell things, they'll do it. And if they don't, just, you know, they're not asking for a handout. They just want to be left alone. And then I'm saying, well, hang on a minute. This is exactly what I was reading about. The anarcho-capitalist thing is just leave me alone to do my thing. Anarcho-capitalism isn't about everyone being a capitalist. It's just about the free flow of, when I say free, I mean genuinely free flow of goods, currency, services, people, whatever it happens to be, ideas. It's just let the system find its own level wherever it happens to be. And I think that is the way in which some of these big overarching political systems, you know, a lot of people commonly will critique, you know, communism or Marxism, whatever, as being a form of dictatorship. And then you, you read, Mark's book, you can see
Fisher's book. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Mark Fisher's book as a capitalist system, as a form of dictatorship that you just described, you know, when you're trying to say what the Marxist idea was. So there is that common ground. It's this top down control, exploitation for whatever color you want to paint it, which is what we're all objecting to, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, it's really funny thing when it comes to capitalism, because I think the other thing about like an anarcho-capitalist and a Marxist that they have in common is, and this is going to sound strange, is their admiration for capitalism. I think what the Marxist admires in capitalism and what the anarcho-capitalists might admire in it are different things, but not entirely different. So, okay, so here's the thing about capitalism that I admire as a wannabe Marxist. It is a system of organizing people and their power as workers. You know, their creative abilities. Maybe not all of their creative abilities, but their physical creative abilities. It's a system that brings people together and creates projects which are can be taken out on a massive scale, and which, once completed, provide material support to humanity on a scale that no other system could provide. In other words, capitalism, well, to be sort of grandiose about it, capitalism got us to the moon. The power of bringing people together to do collective work is breathtaking. But what a Marxist objects to is the fact that only one aspect of humanity is being brought into the fold to do collective work, that you're only brought in as a kind of mule under capitalism, that you don't have the potential, you're not developed as a full person, as a worker. And in fact, capitalism diminishes you much more than previous systems did, because it used to be if you were a worker, you might be an artisan. You'd have a whole set of skills and you could do a whole variety of different things to as a metal worker, or woodworker, or what have you. And now, you've been often enough almost mechanized as a worker, where, your job is to press a certain set of buttons in the right order consistently again and again. So capitalism, the Marxists want to hold on, and this may be a fatal flaw in Marxist thinking. They want to hold on to the power of this collective work while getting rid of the oppression and the exploitation and the dehumanizing requirements of capitalism.
What some people would say, the left perspective would emphasize cooperation and the right perspective would emphasize competition, even though, as you point out, there has to be a lot of cooperation in capitalism to get things done. But I think to steer this around in the direction of Mark Fisher's book, any system can kind of go rogue, be taken too far, that there's an idea that sort of any concept you can come up with, can be brilliant enough such that you can just let it run and run and there are no limits. There is no diminishing returns point that you can reach. And I think certainly the opening section of Mark's book, he talks about the ascendance of neoliberal ideology to the exclusion of all else, mm-hmm. to the point now where for many people, they cannot even imagine an alternative to capitalism. You see the left in so many parts of the world. Look what's happening in Europe now, in the US, the left floundering and just seen as absolutely bankrupt, and the mainstream leftist parties like the Democrats or like the Labour Party, maybe slightly less now in the UK, but for a long time, the UK Labour Party has just been another lighter shade of blue. Really, if you see what I mean, or a lighter shade of red, if you're in the US, it's undeniable. And I spend a lot of time in these shows talking to people about problems in the good old three E's: economy, energy, environment. And a lot of these things are manifesting in Western industrial capitalist societies. And it's generally because it's getting to the point where this system, for all sorts of reasons we don't necessarily have to get into, is got to the point of diminishing returns. It's now starting to eat itself. And Mark is particularly good when he talks about the psychological and the social fallout from this.
Right. Okay, well, a couple points. This is, and I started the whole conversation by saying Capitalist Realism is a book which sort of defines the imprint I work on and my own political theoretical work, such as it is. But it is also a book that I want to transcend. And one of the key differences I might have with Mark, if he were around, and that I have with his book, is around this question of neoliberalism. He's right that it certainly was right in 2009 and for a long time before that, that neoliberalism as a political strategy dominated in such a way that it almost seemed like you couldn't be anything but a neoliberal. But in the last year or so, we've certainly seen that there is an alternative to neoliberalism, or at least there's one in the political imagination, and that alternative is ethnic nationalism, or what I'll call proto-fascism. So the moment we're in now is one in which most people that I know are stuck trying to figure out whether or not they want to embrace this neoliberalism, or a risk seeing the only alternative, on the horizon take its place, which is ethno-nationalism. And I think it's important to point out that, in fact, neoliberalism is only a management strategy for capitalism. It is not capitalism itself. And that when we were living when people were living in a Fordist period or a period of Keynesian spending and the New Deal, when the NHS was being formed, this was still a capitalist system, and the managers of capitalism, the political class, just had a different set of priorities and strategies around how to manage it. And, you can always develop new strategies for how to manage it. And in fact, new strategies are still being developed. And there is a left version of an alternative to neoliberalism right now. It's not ethno-nationalism. It's not even primarily nationalism, although there's aspects of it that are. But it's an effort to kind of return to what in the States I think of as New Deal politics, to expand the welfare state, do a lot of redistribution, do a lot of infrastructure spending and federal government spending to try to direct the market that way, and to basically go the opposite way from neoliberalism. But the main problem of capitalism, which is in the title of Marx's book, would remain in all three cases. It would remain under neoliberalism, it would remain under ethno-nationalism, and it would remain under, a return of the New Deal. And so getting beyond capitalist realism, one first step in that direction is to also get beyond the thought that neoliberalism and capitalism are the same, that if you get past neoliberalism, you've gotten past capitalism, because that isn't the case.
Well, you mentioned, it's very relevant just right here today in the UK, you mentioned proto-fascism as a sort of an emerging, re-emerging thing. The UK is about to have a general election in the not-too-distant future, but today there were kind of local council, kind of city-type elections, and the Conservatives, that being the on the right of the political spectrum party, have had a sweeping gains. This is at a time of, I haven't really known such political disenchantment in my life, certainly not maybe since the 1970s in this country. And we're talking about Conservatives winning in places like Scotland, which are generally definitely left-wing socialist perspective.
Labour's, blue wall, right? Scotland.
Exactly. But Labour have lost hundreds of seats, some of them in Scotland to the Scottish National Party. But even the SNP are on the back foot a little bit. They're what seemed like a relentless ascendance has been put the brakes on somewhat. But it's almost like it's not that anyone's really enthused about the Conservative Party, the current version of it, or the leadership or the vision or anything like that. There's a resignation in this. There's no question about it. And I've listened to some of political pundits seem to find a way to get the most ill-informed people on the street when they're doing vox pops. But listening to the feedback today, there's a definite resignation and also a complete inability to articulate why people who were lifetime Labour voters are now voting Conservative.
Well, the Labour Party and the Democratic Party aren't exactly the same.
Because I get half the people who listen to these things are in the USA and Canada, so just orientating for them, that's all.
Right. Yeah, the Labour Party it would be close to our Democratic Party. I just think the Labour Party in Britain has a little bit more potential than the Democratic Party in the United States. UKIP, though, isn't doing well, right?
Oh, they've lost every seat that they were contesting. Now it's almost 8 p.m. here and all the results are not in, but they've been wiped out, and their explanation for this and most commentators' explanation is that the Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union, that was the raison d'etre of UKIP. And now that that's in the works, they're just not required anymore. You can have a view one way or another about that, but they were certainly seen as a very real threat at one point, particularly to the Tories. But I think the Tories have kind of, like the blob in the old sci-fi film, the Tories have kind of assimilated the voters who were at that end of the spectrum.
Yeah, see, the thing is, if you dig down, it starts to get confusing, and direct analogies from one country to another don't hold. So, like, who does Theresa May really, and who does the Tory party really align with? I don't think the Tories really are aligned directly with the Trump wing of the Republican Party. I mean, Trump seems to be more naturally inclined towards, or he did anyway, when Bannon had some sway in the White House, towards the UKIP side of British politics. And I don't see, like, Hillary Clinton and Theresa May as being completely opposed. So it's, I really should turn to you and ask, you know, where do you see the analogies between U.S. politics and British politics? And also, what do you think about the French election? Where do things line up there? I mean, Le Pen and the Tory party, they're obviously not the same. The National Front is more closely aligned with UKIP, which is, in the UK, is completely irrelevant now. So I'm not sure how to read the moment, if there really is a proto-fascist uprising or not.
Well, I suppose there's underlying threads of what we're saying about the structure of ideas and how that could be written, you know, how that could manifest in society. And then there's actual political parties, which is groups of people cherry picking some of the ideas from here, there, and everywhere. And you're right, that's why it doesn't all match up comfortably at all. I mean, if Trump came to the UK, or if he suddenly, you know, in a parallel universe, he was a UK politician, he would be with UKIP. I mean, that would be his natural territory. If Clinton, in an alternate universe, was a UK politician, she'd be, you know, middle of the road, one nation Tory. That's what she would be, you know. She's
probably, or she might be a Blairite Labour.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's telling in itself, because Blair, you know, it was just so obviously, you know, everything about him was conservative, and that's how he managed to take the Labour Party to those landslide victories, was basically by dumping everything that had gone before. Yeah. And funnily enough, there's a well-known comedian here in the UK called Rick Mayall. And in the 1980s, he invented this is during Thatcher era. He invented a comedy character called Alan Bastard. And he was a right-wing, sort of jingoistic, very nasty piece of work, conservative Tory politician. And he brought the character back during the Blair era. And same guy, Alan Bastard, but he was now New Labour. And he just did the same show. It was exactly the same show. But
yeah.
All the gags and all the prejudices, everything about it was just translated across perfectly.
So, and here's the other thing, just about Trump for a moment. Right now, it looks like that the more traditional, I'm going to call it neoliberal, although it's often called neoconservative, although those are different, those are categories in different terrains, really. But it looks like the traditional establishment wing of the Republican Party is ascendant, that Paul Ryan and his people are sort of dominant right now, that Trump is an empty suit, and that we're not seeing any real rise of America First nationalism in the United States, and that was all bluster and for show. And if the French election goes the way I think it will, I think that this far-right nationalist racist threat probably will turn out to be a blip, and that we still are dealing with neoliberal realism, even though it looked for a moment like scarily we could plunge off that track and into the abyss.
It's kind of like people have seen John Carpenter's The Thing. Neoliberalism, you know, we try and sort of, it sort of shows up in different places in different guises, or maybe you could say the same about capitalism. You know, it kind of, it occupies different forms and different moments, anything to try and survive when it's threatened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely right. So the question is, for someone who like me, who's on the left, is what do we do in the face of this new transformation of the neoliberal order? And how can we get beyond fighting that into fighting capitalism, which is, again, the title of Mark Fisher's book, which is Capitalist Realism, Not Just Neoliberal Realism. What? That's our question. So anyway, I kind of posed a question that I can't answer to you, and of course you can't answer it.
No, I certainly can't. I mean, that's... Well, I've written very often about the, because I know Mark mentions Francis Fukuyama and the whole sort of end of history thing, which I always thought was preposterous. I mean, at the time, I just thought, what is this guy talking about? But it seemed, you know, from that perspective of, you know, his acolytes or whatever, it could seem like it was very logical. And, but then I remember as a cultural critic thinking that all the, retro mania that was around in the 1990s, I was thinking, well, it's a run up to the millennium. You know, when we get past this, new ideas, people maybe feel a bit freer, not so much shackled to the past, and who knows what might happen. And actually, the retromania just intensified after 2000. And there was this great feeling of not only the aforementioned diminishing returns within the overall capitalist system, and not even stagnation wasn't enough. And I'm talking now about economically and culturally and socially, but actually just going backwards. And when I think about Mark's perspective, again, another thing that he does in the book that he's very skilled at was referencing popular culture to kind of give us a very visceral, full spectrum, you know, technicolor vision of what he's trying to get across in his, you know, for his perspective on capitalism. And he talks about late capitalist dystopia versus traditional totalitarian vision of the future. And he references the British film Children of Men, and he talks, I loved his phrase, where in this internment camps exist alongside coffee chains. It was like a Blade Runner type vision of the future where you've almost got totalitarianism, but you've got this seemingly endless choice, but really the endless choice in these type of dystopias is kind of, you could say that which we have now today, you know, we can go on Amazon and buy any kind of crap, you know, if we've got the money, or if we don't, if we don't have the money, we can still get it, we can borrow it. and that is this kind of substitute for freedom, which is ultimately what we're talking about here, is us as individuals having choice about what it is we do with our lives, whatever system we choose to participate in. And I think just Mark was very good on that. It's just very, very vividly brought to life. And it doesn't matter what perspective, for my money anyway, reading his book, it almost doesn't matter what end of the political spectrum you're coming from. He identifies a malaise at all levels, to greater or lesser extent, that is palpable. And you can, again, we're not even talking about what is the solution to that, what are the fixes, what are the answers. It's there. And in some ways, Mark's book kind of leaves it hanging, which is all the more poignant for me as he's no longer with us.
Yeah. Well, it's a couple of you said a lot of different things, and there, and so I'm going to pick and choose to what I respond to. The first thing that's really interesting about say Children of Men and that vision of, you know, camps next to coffee chains is that real totalitarian governments and occupied countries often have that character. So for instance, a while back some photos were unearthed of people out for the day at the cafes in France and Paris during occupation. And these are just regular French folks who are out and about enjoying their day in the cafes. There's a really interesting photograph of three young women enjoying the sun in sunglasses at a cafe in Paris. You know, and it looks like something that could that it sort of has a universal or a transhistorical hipness. These are the beautiful people. This is, they're living the good life. You can just tell by at a glance. They've got a kind of Hollywood allure to them, and they're living under, you know, occupation, you know, by the Nazis. So this dilemma between consumer freedom and political unfreedom, freedom for some and horrible oppression and death for others. That defines not just totalitarian occupations, but really the world that we live in. The other thing is about nostalgia. It's interesting to me to agree with Mark about how intense the nostalgia is and how deep it is. And also know, though, that I've grown up and lived my adult life all through an era of just completely caught up in nostalgia. And I was born in 1970, and so my first decade was a decade of nostalgia for the 50s. If I had been born 10 years earlier, I would have lived through a decade which was caught up in nostalgia for the 20s. In the 80s, there was nostalgia for the 60s. In the 90s, there was nostalgia for the 70s. And then, you know, in the last 20 years or 16 years, 17 years, there's been a nostalgia for the 80s and, I don't know, an opening up where now there is nothing but nostalgia. It's, you can be nostalgic for anything now. So, I think it characterizes the last, maybe 50 years or more of our culture. And I think it's just getting more intense all the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a thought I've often had. I think you could maybe extend that back, actually, into the dawn of, industrialization. And the idea is that maybe on some sort of psychosocial level that the world, albeit, the world that we have set in motion collectively is kind of moving too fast for us. And, technology is that's faster than our brains can develop. This reminds me of, again, a phrase from Marx's book that he talks about capitalism just in general as something that primitive and feudal societies warded off in advance, almost like the dangerous, the psychopathic member of the tribe that has to be taken out into the woods and quietly killed before they can actually threaten the safety of the collective, And so I think I could trace it back to the Industrial Revolution anyway. Again, when people were herded off the land into cities and what have you.
Right. Well, this is, the problem with capitalism is that it's very dynamic. It develops and is constantly changing. Nothing stands still. And it does all of this in a completely inhuman, alienating way, even as it provides us with some benefits and wealth. It also it's kind of strips us of our agency and our control over our society. The question now is, do we even have a culture a good portion of the time? And I think that there's a desire to sort of hold on to human agency and look for times when we had it and where life made sense. I also think, though, some of this is just the typical kind of problem that people have with aging. And if you look back on your youth, your young adulthood, you often recognize that you had it better than you thought, and it was better to be young than to be older, and those were better days. So, there's that too.
There is. Well, what I was just saying actually set off and train another thought about, in terms of, casualties of this, and what I've talked about earlier, diminishing returns, and there's an old quip, I can't remember who came up with this, that sort of alcohol is both the source of and the solution to all of life's problems. And you can kind of say that, capitalism is both the source of and the solution to all life's problems. Because it seems like, doesn't it, from capitalist perspective, if something's going wrong, you need more capitalism. Things are just not quite free enough. And there isn't quite enough competition in the system. You allow more of the same, and eventually it'll fix itself, because that's what the system does. It finds the best solution in any set of given circumstances. And it seems now that for a long time, to different degrees, it's been self-evident that, everything should be run as a business. And we've seen this creeping into more and more areas of life and bringing with it more and more problems, because it seemed like, education, health, transport, justice now, we all look on this side of the pond with horror at some of the things that go on in a US prison system, you know, the commercialized side of it. Law enforcement, even, you know, defense, even the arts, it's kind of like everything has to be run as a business now. This is just a larger version of that's imposed upon us as individuals, that basically we have to justify ourselves economically in order to exist.
Right. But now it's also, you know, all of this is part of neoliberalism, right? The neoliberal advance and hegemony. So it used to be that, you know, the power of the state was a moderating influence on capitalism. Now the state is basically just an instrument of the capitalists. And I mean, it's always been an instrument, but it's just got new strategies now. And so the idea is, let the market take care as much of it as it can. You know, it's seemingly having some hiccups. The problem is it's got too many hindrances. We need to, the way I look at it is like, you know, we lower the interest rates, right, in order to try to keep capital flowing. And the same thing's true here. We give more and more of our world to capitalism in order to just try to keep it running, try to stave off another Great Depression. I'm not sure it's going to be successful.
Well, to what extent do you think that conventional structures of control, you know, regulation in the form of governments, world banks and other things like this can exercise that control anymore? Because it seems that that in many ways, governments of whatever shade, their hands seem to be tied in a way. You know, it's because we've seen particularly with, you know, the internet, but with, you know, we have banking without borders. So capital can move out. It's very fluid, very nimble. If someone tries to enact some legislation somewhere to get some kind of control over this, then, you know, the money moves elsewhere. The corporations relocate their headquarters, even though they might just do it in a boiler room basis, so it's all on paper. We hear in endless, endless interviews, particularly any time there's a blow up in one of the banks, they keep talking about the talent. It's always talent, isn't it? You know, the talent will go somewhere else. If we, you know, if you start to regulate the City of London, or you just regulate New York or Frankfurt or, you know, Singapore, the talent will go elsewhere. And it's,
yeah.
But as we know, this is a race to the bottom. And it seems that we've been engaged in that for quite some time now. But all the areas I mentioned just previously about being open to privatization, all of them are suffering these horrendous negative feedback loops of consequences. It's cliche in itself to say that, oh, well, you know, we're at some kind of tipping point. I'm not necessarily sure that we are, but I do wonder how much unraveling and how many problems within these various systems can be allowed to keep tripping forward, stumbling from one kind of disaster to the next before something fundamentally changes. It might be on a very piecemeal basis. Because, you know, there's a natural limit, you know, end point to these systems, you know, or is there? Can they just do a magic reset, writing off a load of debt or, you know, anything that exists in the virtual world, it's not the physical world? Can they just say, oh, well, it'll put it back to zero now and off we go again?
Well, okay, a lot of what you're asking me now is about economic issues, and to really answer it, we'd have to go in depth, and I'd have to, you know, probably pull out books and prepare, but just on a kind of sketchy level, here's what I think about it. The thing to remember is that everybody wants capitalism to work, and what you got is a debate about what will make it work best. So, like all the real political class, there's no one in the political class that wants to get beyond this system of capitalist production and exploitation and the rest. And my view is that capitalism goes into crisis on a regular basis. It has problems in its foundation, regardless of whether you're talking about, you know, a New Deal Fordist version of capitalism or a neoliberal, you know, let the markets decide everything, let's have private prisons version of capitalism. Both will go into crisis. So the question that we're asking, most people in politics anyway, are asking right now is, how can we keep it going just a little longer? What will be the best approach to keep it going? Another 4 years, say, until, you know, I'm up for re-election. To answer that question is difficult. It's not usually the question I think of, although lately I've thought about it more, because if you, I happen to think that if you really did try to implement full-on nationalist policies, and restart the New Deal, do a lot of infrastructure spending, and slow down the flow of capital internationally, you know, maybe tax transactions, that what you'd have is a crisis, economic crisis. It's not a matter of talent leaving. It's a matter of money leaving and a matter of debt accruing and just a matter of economic crisis. So, you know, things would get worse in Europe. The euro would go down. Things would get worse in the UK. The pound would fall. But also, you know, unemployment would go up. There's just a whole slew of things that probably would be the bad consequences for a nationalist redo of the New Deal. On the one hand, there's that. On the other hand, though, if you did that and there was a crisis, there would at least be some policies in place to help the people who are suffering the most. So, and at certain points, working people would probably be better off, even as the economy started to crumble, if we had a lot of New Deal policies in place. But it would be short-lived, and there would be a huge, pushback against that, those policies. So, and here's the other thing to think about, is that capitalism does have a magic bullet. It's called a depression. When there's a depression, you know, capitalist value goes down. There's a reevaluation of the value of factories and businesses. Everything becomes dirt cheap, and it becomes easier to make a profit again. So if you allow for a depression to fully hit, you can have a reboot of capitalism, of the whole system. The downside to that is, along with it, there's a tremendous amount of human misery and often a lot of political strife. And the last time it happened, there was a world war. So we have such weapons now that we want to avoid that, because it could be that, you know, the amount of bloodshed needed for capitalism to reinvigorate itself would be cataclysmic at this point. So it's not really an option to let capitalism fix itself, as it tends to want to do. I think we're pushed to a point where we have to get beyond the system. We have to transcend capitalism itself if we want to get out of our current problems and crises. But I don't see anyone, including myself, who has any plan that would allow that to happen.
That which cannot be sustained will not be sustained. It's just what kind of mess we're going to be left to clear up and what shape we'll be in to do so.
Right.
But it seems that it kind of seems crazy in a way, doesn't it? You know, we don't let's take another ecosystem, kind of socio-economic ecosystem, like say the family, for example. Most families don't go into a death spiral of competition and crisis. It just ends up in bloodshed and deaths.
No.
So what is it about that little sort of nuclear idea of, you know, running human affairs that we seem to be able to, with a few exceptions, kind of allow to function? And in fact, it's kind of a core unit, you know, of human life. We sort of take things up a notch into thinking earlier, you know, but I mentioned, tribal and feudal societies and what have you. You know, you increase the size of systems, and it seems that we get to a certain point where something flips and it seems to take on a life of its own. Then we're generally into problems. I would contend, no matter whereabouts on a political or economic theoretical perspective you might put those systems, it seems to be a size thing.
Yeah. Look, the one of the things about capitalism that is great is that we now have this realm of private leisure and private lives. So that public-private split is liberating in a way. It's why in the United States there's a feeling of classlessness. It's because you may have to go to work and take your boss's orders during the day, but at night and on weekends, you and he are equal in the market. And the realm of the family is also a realm of relative freedom and leisure now. It wasn't the case when we were agricultural. You know, the family was an economic unit. but it's less so now. And so wanting to escape into the family or into these sort of tribal associations between friends who don't work together, for profit, that's just like wanting to have one side of capitalism without the other. And that's just not going to work. So now if you want to retreat back into feudalism, then you're going to have to let go of a lot of what you have now. And, probably you're going to see, mass extinction. Feudal societies just couldn't produce enough to feed everybody. We have, 6 billion people now, almost 7. The kind of economy that feudal societies could come up with wouldn't support that. So, yeah, we're stuck. We're not going to be able to go back to the past.
To be honest with you, I think one way or another, whatever this looks like, I think we're going to end up, we will get to a point somewhere in the medium term, I would estimate, with a much smaller global population. That doesn't mean people are thinking in apocalyptic terms. I think it will happen over a period of time. And a lot of it will be through the birth rate falling, actually. There might be increased death for various reasons. But without invoking the apocalypse, I think that's what we're going to see. And I think it'll just be by necessity. And it'll just put us, we'll have no choice, but it'll put us in better shape to at least try and take a step forward into what? I don't know.
I hear you. You are now the mouthpiece of capitalism because, a die-off would be a useful thing for capitalists, not for capitalists, but for capitalism as a system. It, that would be part of the consequence of the Depression would be a massive, amount of death. And whether or not it would be on the scale you're dreaming up here, I don't know. But it certainly, that is the capitalist solution, is to allow a lot of people to die, to risk even extinction, and hope that if there's enough damage but not too much done, that the whole system can reboot and it could be a little bit more utopian. I mean, a lot of times people look back to the 50s and 60s as a time in which life made sense. It's not only because people are racist that they do that. I mean, it's not just because that was before, in the United States, desegregation and the civil rights movement. But it's also because the economy was really good then. And there was a sense that if you just had a middle class job, in other words, a working class job, you could raise a family and lead a decent life. All of that was born though, on the back of, or born out of, World War II. It was all born out of a massive depression, huge bloodletting, and, basically human sacrifice. I mean, in a sense, capitalism is a religion and, it's a pagan one, which demands human sacrifice.
Well, I did say, actually, a fall in the birth rate as opposed to mass die-offs.
Yeah, I know you did. I just sort of ignored that unfairly, I suppose.
No, that's fine because I'm not, again, I don't feel that I've got a dog in the fight from an ideological point of view. Obviously I've got irons in the fire just to start mixing up metaphors here, but, I just think it's what I see. It's the latest version of what I would put money on if I was a betting man. That might change. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I think, I have, kids. I have 4 kids now and they're all getting older. My youngest is 12. I can't believe it. And I think that part of human life is, having families reproducing, passing on your genes and bringing children into the world. And I think the idea that we should hope that some people don't do that and that will be our big political solution is, I understand the appeal and, right thinking people often don't have as many kids as I do these days, but, I just don't think that that's, I think that there's something fundamentally misanthropic about that approach. That I'm not that we shouldn't control the birth rate, not that we should just – I mean the truth about high birth rates is that they're usually coming – they come hand in hand with high rates of infant mortality. So if you're talking about bringing down the birth rate by bringing up the level of industrialization and longevity – then I'm with you. But if you're looking for a decline in the birth rate, that doesn't come hand in hand with the improvement in people's human lives and everyday lives, then what you're talking about really is probably an increase in infant mortality, and along with the declining birth rate in the richer areas, and you know, it will just be ugly.
Yeah, and again, I'm not advocating anything. It's just the
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just like making my perspective.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'm fine with, you know, with attempts to put me on the spot or whatever. I just, again, it's like, what would you kneel to the mast right now? Which mast would you kneel it to? And it's like, okay, I just think that's how things seem to be headed. That's all.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I'd love to be proven wrong. Well, one thing I'll say, you know, as we kind of begin to wind us up for today is that, we've been discussing ideas spinning off from Mark Fisher's book recently republished. That's entitled Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative?
And yeah, it has never gone out of print. That's the thing about that book. It just keeps selling.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, anyway, there's, you know, it's been re-promoted, shall I say then, which is why we were talking about it. And one of the things that Mark was very, very moving on again in his book is writing about spiraling rates of depression, particularly in, you know, in industrialized societies, this in a stage of late capitalism that we're in. And again, this is affecting people. It doesn't matter what they vote for. It's, you know, does not affected by that. And he's very poignant when he talks about that. And I see these sort of side effects a great deal. And there is a certain malaise in late capitalism whereby the system that promises us all these things, if we just play along, if we just work hard, the opportunities are there. It's the American dream, isn't it? And all these other versions of it in various industrialized economies around the world. It's you can have it. And if you don't quite get it, well, either you're not trying hard enough or you're not talented enough, or well, come with time. But it does actually go to those who work hardest and who are the most deserving, the talent. And that's just not happening now. And there's not anyone out there, some kind of Wizard of Oz type character trying to deprive people of these things. It's just that the system is malfunctioning, even in its own terms, cannot deliver all of these things, all of these air conditioning units and chest freezers and whatever it is, you know, a Prius in every driveway, you know, and a sit-down lawnmower on every lawn. It's just, it can't be done. People have become so immersed in the system. I mentioned at the top of the hour, you know, for many people, we can't envision anything else other than some other kind of flavor of this, and that this whole system will eventually do what it has always done. It'll get through this little rough patch, and we'll be on our way again, two steps forward, one step back. But don't worry, because that step forward is just around the corner. Just a little bit more unfettered capitalism. We'll get there.
Yeah. Well, I agree. You know, that is certainly seemingly in the cards. But I think that there's a chance that we could, you know, as things get worse, the people could organize and try something new. I still hold hope for that.
I know you mentioned this a little bit in terms of like the emerging proto-fascism. Do you see anything that you can flag up as positive along the lines of what you just said, even at very nascent developments, anything at all? What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is also a bitter pill to swallow at the moment. Like, I'm finding that the New Deal left is at least more honest than most other political actors. And that if I were to throw my support in any direction, it would be towards someone like Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders, even as I see them not being able to ultimately work their way past the real dilemma we're in. But I think that if there's just an effort made to try in a humane way and through kind of solidarity, try to produce a world in which more people are included and more people have a chance at a decent life, even though there will be massive pushback, even though it'll fly in the face of the economy's own demands, I think that there's a chance there that if we could see some victories for people like Corbyn or Sanders, or I forget the French politicians. It's not that I forget it. I can see it, but I can't pronounce it. The hologram man in France. that would be where I would put some of my eggs. But also, I think we need to think more, and not to be crass or it seem false, but reading books about political theory, reading books like Mark Fisher's, may not immediately produce a political result, but it's helpful, I think. And, you know, some things really are going to be starting in embryo, and maybe in our imaginations first.
Just in closing, Doug, I just want to say something about Mark, say Mark Fisher, author of this book we've been discussing, because we've mentioned a couple of times he's no longer with us. And it was quite a shock to me as someone who never met Mark, and I only know his work through reading this compact little book of his. But
yeah, I mean, the story there is that I sent you that book when he was alive as a possibility to get him on your podcast, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, well, perhaps you can just tell people how things unfolded after that, to the best of your knowledge.
I don't know very much. I do know that Mark is, I mean, he had written about his depression in a book called Ghosts of My Life. And he wrote about depression in the abstract too. I mean, just as a concept, as something that comes along with what he called capitalist realism. So he thought that fighting depression was a political act. Let me just describe what I was getting at with that was just that he had a history of depression, and while it was very sad to discover he had taken his own life, it was not completely outside the bounds of the possible in retrospect, although of course no one expected it who didn't live very, you know, didn't know him really personally. But I don't know what exactly happened. All I know is what was announced by his widow on Facebook, and that he had taken his own life. But that's all I know there. The other thing I'll say is that my relationship with Mark was one which was unfortunate, because I really liked him, and he seemed to like me fine. I'd interviewed him a few times for a previous podcast I did before I started working at Zero Books. And in fact, when I did talk to him after the first interview, he said, "I'd like to do this more often. We should do this on the regular." Which I wanted to do. And he was a brilliant guy. And but he left Zero Books along with Tariq, a few years back now, right? And I got the job because there was this sudden vacancy. I mean, they left en masse. They were collectively unhappy with how things were working out with the parent company of Zero Books, and they left. And at the time, I was working just a McJob job and thought it was an opportunity, so I applied and got the job. Since then, you know, things have gotten better, I think, with the parent company, although it's up and down with any big company. But the unfortunate side effect of me taking that job was that even though he didn't hold it against me personally, and even though we did talk once and even thought about doing another podcast, that never came together, and there was just such bad blood around them leaving that I never did get to know Mark as well as I would have liked to. And having him gone now, it does make me kind of sadly grateful for what he had done, and respect what they did, Tariq and Mark did together, looking at his book, particularly Mark's book, that I'm lucky to be working for Zero Books and to be working kind of in their shadow.
Yes, well, you referenced one of Mark's other books there, which is Ghosts of My Life, Writings on Depression, Hauntology, and Lost Futures. And that's something now which is kind of the next thing on the list for me. So I feel that I must read it after everything that's happened. But in any event, capitalist realism is out there. As you say, it's never been out of print as such, but as widely available, isn't it, if people want to get a copy of that?
Yeah, and one of the things that's and a sort of a silver lining to Mark's really premature death and is that his work is being reappraised and also becoming more popular. There was certainly when people found out he had died, there was a rush to get his books. And I think that, you know, one of the markers of a successful career as a writer is that after you die, people keep reading you. And I think that's certainly going to be the case with Mark. He'll be read for as long as we have neoliberalism, which may be too long.
Okay, right. Well, Doug, just final thing. Is there anything else you'd like to put out there?
Yeah, well, you know, Zero Books is a book publisher, but we also have a podcast that comes out on the regular. And if you go to zero-books.net, you can find links to our blog and to our podcast. And, you know, if you enjoyed listening to me babble today, you can go and listen to me babble at other people and interview people at the Zero Books podcast. The other thing I'll say is, you know, we have a YouTube channel. We're producing little 10-minute theoretical videos that I do sitting right here at this same computer, and I would appreciate if people went and looked at them. And also, one other thing, a really great book's coming out from Zero Books called Kill All Normies. And it is a look at the alt-right. Angela Nagel is the author of that. She's a writer for The Baffler and for Jacobin and for Current Affairs and The Atlantic. And she's quite talented. She's going somewhere, and her book is kind of a must-read. And the one last thing, I do have a book that I'm writing for a science fiction novel. Another one's coming. It's called Batch Batch Revolution, and someday soon I'll finish it and turn it in, and that book will be coming soon. So there's everything, all of my wares to sell. The Marxist hawking his product. It's ironic.
Splendid. Okay, well, Doug, thanks so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.